Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, we help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Our doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true health starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com. That's abilitychiro.com.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Hello and welcome to Hurt Less, Live More, a show where we acknowledge the hurt we experience in life and find ways to move on from that and live life to the full, or as full as we can anyway. I'm JJ Stenhouse, the practical alchemist, and with me, as ever, is psychiatrist and coach Dr. Mark Goulston, plus our guest today, Charlotte Culkin. And Mark, I'll let you do the honours of introducing Charlotte a little bit more, but just to suffice to say, Charlotte's going to be talking about restorative justice, which is a huge subject, so important, and something which is transformational. But Mark, I'll hand over to you.
Well, thank you, JJ. And it's so wonderful to meet you, Charlotte. And I met Charlotte via Margaret Heffernan, who is also a guest on this show. And she recommended Charlotte highly. And as JJ said, when you hear the word restorative justice, it really seems to fit with the theme of what we're talking about, that there's, when you, I don't know what the opposite of restorative justice would be, punitive justice, I'm not sure, but there's a hurt in the injustice side of justice. And so we would love to hear how you came to be doing what you're doing, what spoke out to you about the whole thing, and then let's have a conversation.
Lovely. Looking forward to it. Looking forward to it a lot.
So how did you get into it, Charlotte? What was it that spurred you into taking up the baton, if you like?
I had a very serious motorbike accident, and it put me out for about a year. And I was living abroad at the time. And when I returned to the UK, I knew I wanted to do something different. And I'd been on sabbatical as well. And I didn't know what. And I went and visited, someone asked me if I'd go and visit a women's centre. And whilst I was there, it was for women who were after they left jail. And to give them support. And whilst I was there, they said, we're just about to start restorative justice. And I said, what's that? And they said, where people who are harmed and people who harm have conversations together. And I thought, I said, that sounds really interesting. And they said, well, the training starts next week. Do you want to do it? And I went, yes, please. And That's how I got into it. I knew nothing about it. And when I did the course, this is how I felt. I felt I'm not going to stop doing this until I get as good as I possibly can. And nothing had made me feel like that before. And I'm still learning 13, 14 years later.
I love that. I love that. What were you doing before, as a matter of interest?
I ran a business and I started, I ran a design business, but my degree was in theatre and drama. And it was really interesting because it was only after doing this work that I realised that what interested me about theatre and drama was the way conversation is constructed. And that's what actually fascinated me. It wasn't standing on a stage and acting. It was the way you can interpret words and how people construct dialogue. And the work I do now actually is a combination of restorative justice and restorative practice, and they are different. So restorative justice is the conversation between harmer and harmed. And restorative practice takes all the principles of restorative justice and looks at how you can weave it across whole organizations to create places where people like to go to work. So I do both. I do restorative justice and restorative practice.
I love the sound of that. Mark, what do you think about that?
You just triggered something. I'll just share this with you. I got into podcasting. So I have a podcast called My Wake Up Call. But I got into podcasting because prior to that, I had a podcast called Prison Letters with Dr. Mark Goulston. So one of my books was called Get Out of Your Own Way, and it found its way into prisons and jails. And I'd been getting letters, still do, for 25 years. And what would happen is I would read the letter and I would drill down what is going on in the mind of this person. And for instance, I think the first program, I received a letter. I won't mention the person's name. And there was a cover letter that said, I have finally owned up to the fact that I murdered these people's son. And I made excuses for many years, and I finally owned up to it. And here is the letter that I sent to this person's parents. And it was so articulate and so compassionate. He talked about, I robbed you of your future, and I don't expect you to write back to me or respond. And it was just so touching. And his cover letter to me was, I'm not sure that I'll hear from these people, but do you have any ideas about what you can say to the parents of someone you murdered?
Well, I do a lot of, I mean, my specialism in the restorative justice field is complex and sensitive cases. Those are the cases that I tend to do the most. And I think the difference between a letter of apology or accountability and a restorative letter is quite massive. So a restorative letter would only respond to what the victim's needs are. So in a restorative letter, you would reach out to the parents and ask them, if you were to receive a letter from the person who killed your son, what would you want to hear in it? What would you want? What questions would you want answered? And how? What would you like to say? And for me, I think it's extremely important that it's a two-way dialogue. And I think that it's extremely important that the I think a letter of apology is extremely valuable as a piece of work. Sometimes I don't think they ought to go near the harmed party because I don't think they will necessarily respond to the harmed party's needs. And we only know the harmed party's needs if we ask them.
That's very, very interesting. As you were talking, I was thinking how I might respond to a letter of apology in certain situations. And I could feel myself bridling at the letter of apology. I could feel myself really saying, and, you know, so what? Wouldn't have changed a thing. In fact, would have just annoyed me in a certain situation. And that's what you're saying is the difference, really, because sometimes it's not appropriate.
What I'm saying is that it has to meet the needs of the recipient. And there are examples of letters with extremely good intention that did not necessarily land well. And I'll tell you, for one, why. Because sometimes a harmer might have done a lot of work on themselves and be in a very good place. And the harmed parties might not be there themselves and might not want to hear that. And so it has to be a two-way process. It has to be to meet the needs. And I think that it has to be, particularly in complex and sensitive cases, I think all restorative work has to be mutually beneficial. It's not for the harmed, it's not for the harmer, it's mutually beneficial, but it is driven by the victim's needs in a complex and sensitive case because of the level of trauma that has been experienced. And I think all of our work is trauma-informed. No, I don't think all of our work is trauma-informed. And I think that it's extremely important when you're doing letters that you approach it just as if you were going to have a face-to-face conversation. I work a lot with a young man called Jacob who was convicted of manslaughter, and he worked for a very long time before, a lot through letters, before he met the parents of the boy who passed. And for him, the process was very slow and very, very much about meeting everybody's needs. And he comes up with a wonderful line. He actually spoke at a conference I did. And he said, "The people who I had harmed the most judged me the least." And I thought that was a remarkable line. And I think that's one of the benefits of restorative justice, that through that slow process of maybe shuttle work and letters and conversation, we can get past some of the slightly simplistic views that people have about crime. Because on the whole, if you dig down to what a harmed person's needs are, punishment isn't the highest thing that they require. What, if you dig a bit, what they'll say is, "We want the person to not do it again." That's what the need is. So we need to be creating justice systems where that is more likely to happen. And restorative justice, I believe firmly, is much more likely to create a situation where the person will not do the harm again. I don't think you shame people into changing their behaviours.
That absolutely resonates with me. I certainly can see that. Yeah. Mark, you were, going to say something there. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, I love what you're saying, and I'm listening to every word. I wrote this book behind me called Just Listen. And about 5 years ago, I spoke in Moscow. And my latest push for listening is to try to teach the world that whoever you're with, one-on-one, one-on-two, as I am here with you, one-on-1,000, they're always listening for something underneath their listening to you. And what they're listening for is frequently not conscious or clear. But if you can know it's always happening, that they're always listening for something, which is to satisfy a need or relieve them of pain or whatever, just the act of being, knowing that it's happening and being purely curious with no agenda, with a completely beginner's mind, people can pick up that energy because you're validating that whatever they're listening for is worthy of your attention. And if we can practice that in our conversations, even when someone's angry with us in our relationships, if we can allow the person to express or vent themselves, vent what they have to do, and do our best to not get triggered, and just be purely curious about what's that about, what's going on, what's really going on. It's amazing how it can shift conversations. So I'm just taking in every sentence you're saying because I'm just going to think much more about it.
Yeah, and I was thinking as you were saying that, Mark, I'd be curious to know how many people actually do pay attention to that extent in their daily lives. And is this part of the issue in terms of how hurts carry on? They're not healed. They fester. Is this part of the problem that we all face in our daily lives? What do you think, Charlotte?
I think that I do a lot of conversations in the workplace. I do a lot of conversations in the workplace where, and it's very similar to doing neighborhood cases. Think about neighborhood cases or workplace conversations. People are rubbing along pretty well together, right? And then someone says something, because the other part of listening is how the other person communicates. And then someone says something, and party A says something, and party B goes, that's a bit weird. Why did they say that? And then party A thinks, they're being a bit weird. Why are they being a bit weird? And walls start to build, and they don't know, they don't have the skills, which is the work that we do within the workplace, to at that moment have a more constructive and effective conversation. And before you know it, people have become very polarized, and they're behind a very large brick wall, and they are trying to persuade everyone around them how peculiar party B is or how peculiar party A is, because they haven't had a conversation to clear the air, largely because we're not taught how to do it at school. And I think a lot of our work is about teaching some very basic skills, not only in listening, but actually in how do I communicate in a way that will most effectively keep your ears open? Because there are a whole bunch of strategies that I can use that will keep your ears open. And there are a whole bunch of things that I could say which will shut your ears down. Like if I make a whole load of assumptions, your head's immediately going to be going, and you've switched off. You've stopped listening. So actually, if what we can do is encourage people to lean into brave and difficult conversations, which is what a lot of books are talking about now, but no one's saying, here's the toolkit. Yes. Here's how you do it. Here's how you set up a difficult conversation. You have it. You have shared power within the conversation, and you resolve it in a way that works for both of you. You know, I'm just going to say one thing because I think it's interesting, which is last week I held a restorative circle with an organization, and someone fed back to someone else who then got in touch with me about another conversation. And they said watching the restorative process was like watching alchemy.
Mm.
And I thought that, JJ, you might like to hear that.
Yeah, absolutely. I love it. And you're very much talking my language there as well. I am loving this conversation. We have got to take a break right now, though. We'll be right back after this from our station sponsors.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Hurt Less, Live More here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio station, with me, JJ Stenhouse, Dr. Mark Goulston, and our guest today, Charlotte Culkin. And I was loving our conversation before the break, talking about alchemy, which is my thing, and talking about communication. And, you know, I have coached people in communication skills for many, many years and trained in psychology of communication, body language and that sort of thing. And it's really important. But one of my frustrations has always been it's not taught in schools. We are not taught how to communicate. And so we kind of bumble along and then wonder why things don't land and why people don't get us.
And I was teaching a skill the other day in a higher education establishment. Something had gone wrong with a year group. I'd been asked to go in and do a piece of work, and I realized it would really support them if they could have braver conversations safely. And I was teaching them a technique using the restorative questions for themselves, how to communicate themselves using the restorative techniques. And I went around the room and then I got to two students and they were like, blah, 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 and they were just completely brilliant. They were absolutely brilliant. And it's quite a, you know, it's a straightforward technique, but it takes a while to flex the muscle and get good at it. So I said to them, you know, girls, you're really nailing this. And they said, well, you know, not being funny, Shella, but why are you teaching this now? We learned this when we were 9 years old.
Oh.
And I said, where did you go to school? And they said, Canada. And a lot of restorative practice is taught in schools in Canada. And actually, there are an awful lot of schools in the UK that teach restorative practice and use restorative justice as an intervention when things go wrong. And a local school to me, actually, in the playground has a restorative corner. So if you're feeling hurt or you've witnessed an unkind remark or experienced one, you can go and stand in the restorative corner and a restorative advocate will come and have a chat with you and work out the way forward. So
that's fantastic. I'm obviously showing my age here, Charlotte, because that wasn't around when I went to school.
ditto me.
three dittos.
Yeah.
but I think it's happening a lot more.
Yeah, I think it's great that that's happening now. Fantastic. Yeah.
And in fact, what's interesting to me is, I mean, we are working at the moment with psychiatric hospitals, third sector, higher education, schools, workplace, lots of prisons, every single sector imaginable, because these are basic skills that could any environment could benefit from.
Yeah.
And the results are quite astonishing. And we had a psychiatric hospital who started to introduce the techniques in the wards last year, and the number of recorded incidents went down from 13 a day to 1.
Hmm.
That's stunning. It's fantastic.
It's pretty extraordinary. And so there is something alchemic about the work.
There is. And can you give us an idea of what some of those processes are that you're getting people to use in that situation?
So the restorative questions are basically very, very simple. In normal situations, if something goes wrong, the first question people ask is what's happened. So if I was to, you know, say, for example, you turn up at a primary school and the front window has been smashed and you say, what's happened? Front window has been smashed. The next question that people invariably ask, and I always ask this in my training, what's the next question? And people automatically go to who did it?
Yeah.
And we have instantly set up a shaming, blaming culture, instantly. And then the natural third stage from that is, well, how are we going to sanction them?
Mm.
And when we work restoratively, we don't go down that avenue. So we ask what's happened. And then the next question we ask is, how is that impacting on everyone? Why does it matter to us? And then we look at what needs to happen to make it better. So we reduce and minimize the shaming, blaming culture, which is what stops people trusting and feel safe.
Yeah, that's such a huge difference, isn't it? Such a huge difference.
Huge.
Yeah.
So for example, if I was going to express myself, I'd say, you know, this is what happened, you know, whatever it is, when I saw that picture on Instagram. this is why it matters to me and why I care about it and how I feel about it. And this is what I'd like. Mm. So we are shifting the language from you did this to me to an I-based language where I talk about why something matters to me and what my needs are and what would make it better for me.
I love that. I love that. What do you think, Mark?
Oh, I love that. I'm writing it down. Especially that pivot to what was the impact of this on who and what was the impact. And then, and I would imagine you allow them to share what's going on. What I might add is after they share whatever the impact is, I like conversation deepeners. And after they say that, I would add, what's really going on? So when you ask people and they share what the impact is, you say, what's really going on? It can sometimes get them to open up at a deeper level. And the more deeply that people can open up into a space in which they feel that you're really listening to them and considering it. In fact, you might find this interesting. There was someone I was coaching years ago who was an incredibly quick and deep study in conversations. And I said, your challenge is that your quick study can be seen as a superficial and slick study, especially when you're trying to get money from investors. And when they say something, when you jump in, it doesn't feel like you considered what they said because you jumped in and you're not a slick study. You're a deep study, but they don't know that. So we disciplined him that after someone would say something, especially if he wanted something from them, is that he would pause for a couple seconds and then go, hmm. And just the pausing for a couple seconds and going, hmm, you're communicating to them that you took it in, and the hmm was an inviting hmm, that what you're sharing with them is that's worthy of considering, and it changed everything for them. So I'm loving this. I'm loving this. Yeah.
Good. I mean, what I love also when I do the courses online is that people go away and then they create and design resources for their own places. And then they bring them back to me and go, do you want to use this? So, for example, in one school, a teacher came on the course and she just did something so simple. She took an A4 piece of paper, folded it into a triangle, put the restorative questions on both sides, and the order in which they'd go, and when children needed to have a conversation about something difficult, she'd just pop it on the table between them, and they'd have the questions to ask the other party, and then the other party would ask them the questions, and then they'd co-create the solution. So simple, so beautiful. And yes, I wish this was a part of the education system. I mean, if I was given the education that I had needed, it would have included this, because yes, I certainly was not given the skills to know how to express myself in difficulty.
So true. And it really was a shame and blame culture.
Yes.
In schools in our day.
Yes.
You behaved. And I remember at school in Scotland when I was very young, we still had things like the belt. And you got six of the best if you weren't, you know, if you didn't behave. I remember being threatened with six of the belt, for not being able to learn a poem off by heart in the given time.
Wow.
And was made to stand in front of the class and was told to learn it by the end of the period, otherwise. And of course I did just about manage it. And the comment was, you see what the threat of the belt will do to sharpen your memory.
I mean, it's so distressing. And the fact that you can remember it so clearly.
Oh, so many years on, right? Yeah,
it was. I mean, I just cannot get my head around the idea that people think that shaming people will give the desired results.
Absolutely. But do you know something? I still to this day can, well, I probably remember the poem for some time, but I can't even remember the name of the poem now. But I do remember standing in front of the class and feeling so uncomfortable and scared and anxious. Yeah, that's what I remember. That was my takeaway from that lesson, right?
Yeah.
Can I? Shame, feel horrible.
Yeah.
Can I share an exercise? Because, you know, with my book, Just Listen, I'm often, you know, in a similar space and I'm always learning. And you've taught me a great deal, both of you today. Might I share an exercise that I hope will be helpful, that I sometimes use?
Please do.
Often when I'm coaching people, coaching executives, I say, we can talk over at, to, or with people. And you know what you're doing by the other person's body language. You know, when you're talking over them, you're insulting them. When you're talking at them, you're being aggressive. When you're talking to them, you know, they'll nod from the neck up and it's intellectual. That's business as usual. But when you're talking with them, they rest their shoulders because they feel safe. So one of the exercises in imparting this is I will ask people, let's share instances from our life where we've been talked over, at, to, and with. And so when they can recall episodes of when they felt insulted, someone was being aggressive. And what happens is when they work their way to to and with, especially with, many of them become tearful because they're remembering someone being tender and kind to them. And then point out to them, having had that experience, you know, what would be the impact if you toggled between to and with instead of over and at, and then practicing what that would be like, or practicing paying it forward, what that person who talked to and with you was like, in various things. So some of my audiences have found that kind of interesting.
And it's interesting going back to the letter that you talked about at the beginning, because a with process is where both parties design the letter and co-create it together. And we're very keen that when we do restorative work, we work with people. We don't do things to people or for people. We work with them. And, you know, that shares the power, and it's difficult. It's a very oft-used expression, and I don't think people really know how to do it. A lot of organizations will say, you know, well, we work with our people. And I'm always curious about, what do you actually mean by that? So I love that description of over at, to, with.
Yeah, I love that too. Yeah.
Yeah, we mentioned something before the last break, and JJ was aware of it, but there's a term called interbeing, and I think it was originated by this philosopher, Thich Nhat Hanh. I'm mispronouncing it. And basically, interbeing is the space between us, and it's independent of our points of view. And interbeing goes up with empathy, compassion, true understanding, and it goes down with dismissiveness, criticism, and that kind of thing. And when someone introduced the term to me, I could feel it viscerally. And it's very
interesting that about that space between, because I think not only is there a space between us, but one of the quotes that's landed them, sorry to interrupt, but one of the quotes that's landed, I got excited, that's landed most with certainly with the prisoners that I work with, is the quote by Viktor Frankl about between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space is our power to choose our response. And in our response lies our growth and our freedom. And ultimately, I think that that's what we're doing with restorative practice, is we're giving people, the first thing is to notice the space. And once you notice the space, then what do you do with it? Because you can react or you can respond. So what do you want to do? You want to respond. But then unless someone teaches you the tools, how to respond effectively, we're a little bit stymied. So I think that, and that's where our power lies. Our power lies in us finding the space, not just the space between us, but the space within myself to respond, not react. and then be given some tools and go, right, I can use those now.
Absolutely, Charlotte. Loving what you're saying. We'll come back with much more after a break right now, though, because it's time to listen to some more from our sponsors. Back right after this.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Hurt Less, Live More with me, JJ Stenhouse, and Dr. Mark Goulston. And our very special guest today, Charlotte Culkin. And we were talking about spaces, the space in between. And I think, Mark, you've got something more to talk about that.
Well, I collect quotes, and here are two of my favorites. And I hope they're worth remembering because I remember them. I had a mentor, Warren Bennis, and he was known as a deep listener. David Gergen was one of his mentees. David Gergen was a political advisor. And one of my favorite Warren quotes was, "Boredom occurs when I fail to make the other person interesting." And I thought it's just so lovely. And then there's another one from a friend of mine, Dr. Shawnee Duperon, and she co-founded Project Forgive with Desmond Tutu, and it was nominated for a Nobel Peace Award in the 90s. And she borrowed this from someone else, but it's also knocked my head off. And that was forgiveness. Forgiveness is accepting the apology you will never receive. And I think for me, those are just incredibly tender ways of approaching the space that often gets pushed away by people's being in a rush.
I mean, it's interesting you brought up the I love them both. And I think it's interesting you brought up the subject of forgiveness, because a lot of people equate restorative justice with forgiveness.
Yes, they do. Yeah.
And they're not the same.
Yeah.
There is absolutely no, I mean, sometimes it happens as a result of the process, but there is no imperative for it to happen. And I think it's really important that there isn't an assumption made that if I do this process, I will either have to forgive the other party or I will get forgiven. You can have compassion and empathy and understanding without forgiveness.
And does that forgiveness ever manifest?
Yes.
If somebody's gone through the process?
Yes.
But not in the, not necessarily immediately.
Sometimes it's immediate. Right. It depends on the severity of the crime. And sometimes the forgiveness is instant.
Mm-hmm.
But in other cases it doesn't happen. It doesn't surface. And yet it's been a profoundly meaningful and important conversation for all parties who've had their needs met.
Yes. Yeah, that's the important thing, having their needs met. Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think that's the other thing with restorative justice. There is also, there are a fair few assumptions about it. One is that it is a face-to-face conversation, which it can be, but it can also be through letters or through a shuttle process. And it's responding to the needs of the parties. So no one knows what their needs are other than them. And it's very important that we don't go in with expectations of what we think a successful process would be, because we're not them. And so there's something, it's a really wonderful, wonderful thing to witness as a restorative justice facilitator. I mean, it's quite an extraordinary, a humbling, humbling process to witness, and to watch two people reach connection and see each other fully, or more than two, and to be barely part of the conversation. Because that's another thing that's interesting, is the difference between restorative work and mediation, which is very different. Because in mediation, the role of the facilitator is more of a negotiator towards an outcome, which is not what we do. The conversation belongs to the participants. We simply hold it in a safe way. And also, there's a need for accountability in restorative justice, which doesn't necessarily have to be the case in mediation. But it's critical. That's why restorative justice, which another myth, people see it as a soft option. I've been called Mrs. Pink and Fluffy a lot in the past, which I'm not. And actually, the courage to take accountability is huge. And that's why the learning from a restorative process is often so much more than maybe a sanction.
Yes, and I can see the alchemy in that. And I describe alchemy as a transformational process. And the old alchemists were aiming to follow nature's way to create gold. So recreate what nature did in the earth to make gold. And they were trying to do it in the lab. And I see alchemy as this transformational process that we all go through constantly. And so I can absolutely see how this is a key part in the lives of many people who have suffered these hurts, to transform their lives and get past them in a very gentle yet effective and not at all fluffy way.
Completely. It is extremely robust and requires an enormous amount of courage.
Yes.
From all parties. And also, I mean, quite a lot of the workplace restorative justice I do, or neighbourhood restorative justice, actually both parties have been harmed, and quite often both parties are harmers as well. Mm. It's six of one and half a dozen of the other, and there has to be a mutual accountability to be able to move the process forward. And you've just reminded me of a wonderful moment where I was prepping, because you never do restorative justice ever without having prep work. I would never pick up two people and plonk them in a room and say, go on, let's have a lovely conversation. That just doesn't ever happen.
Let's just get through it all. Let's just transform our lives here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Let's just bish, bash, bosh, get on with this. Mm-hmm. And I remember having a conversation with a teenage girl who... where it had got to, she'd fallen out with her best friend. I mean, it had turned into sort of gang warfare and awful things were going on and lots of agencies were involved. And I remember talking to her about how she felt the other party was impacted. And I said to her, so if she was in the room now, what would you say? And she said, sorry. And her shoulders just went,
just dropped. Mm.
So actually the moment for her came in the prep before she went into the conversation. Mm. And there were some charts on the wall. They're called blob charts with emotions. And I said, how are you feeling now? I'd asked her how she was feeling at the beginning using the chart. And she pointed to the person in the air with their arms up in the air with total joy. And it was a incredibly moving and beautiful moment, because she'd freed herself.
Yes, and that's a very important element of it as well, because Mark, one of your books talks all about getting out of your own way, and so freeing up yourself, taking that agency.
You know, and then this I'll flirt with fluffy, because I'm
I love that line.
I'm usually the least alpha person in the room, but well, that's another story. So in the late 1980s and 1990s, I was the world's leading expert on helping divorced couples get back together again. I was on Oprah. I was on Donahue. That dates me, the New York Times, LA Times. And I didn't seek them out. It was just a positive story. And so these were two people who wanted to reconcile, but they didn't have the tools. And one of the things we came up with that I welcome your input because it's been airtight, is that when you traumatize another person, you create hurt, hate, hesitation to trust, and holding on to a grudge, the four H's. And that can be in either end, hurt, hate, hesitation to trust, and holding on to a grudge. And what the four H's need are the four R's. Hurt needs remorse, not regret, but remorse. Hate needs restitution. You took something away, you got to give something back. Hesitation to trust requires rehabilitation. I need to see that you've learned a different way to deal with our conflicts other than the old way. And it needs to be something that you like. It can't just be something to get me off your back. So you need to be able to say, boy, if I'd known this then, we wouldn't have had to get divorced. And then the final one is holding on to a grudge requires the fourth R, which is requesting forgiveness 6 months after you've internalized remorse, restitution, rehabilitation. And you can say, look, I don't expect you to forget what happened, and I can't change the past. And I hope you have felt that I've shown remorse, restitution, and that I'm doing it differently, and I would like you to forgive me. But they balance very nicely to each other. And again, but this is not restorative justice. This is restorative intimacy. After you've lost the trust with each other, people found that helpful as a way to earn back intimacy.
And I think there are many ways that you can use, certainly restorative justice, I think, is one of the most, one of the things that we have in the UK is an understanding. Oh, I'm going to get in terrible trouble. I can't remember the name of the report, but it called family the golden key to rehabilitation. And the golden key to rehabilitation is family. And the problem in jails is that when you go on visits or when you're in having phone calls, you never have, not from my experience, and I think I've worked in 42 jails, you never have those conversations. The difficult conversations don't happen. So actually restorative justice can be a fantastic tool in family work. And it has the win-win benefit that we know that you're far more likely to not commit crime again if you have built bridges with your loved ones.
So important, isn't it? Honestly, Charlotte, we could talk for days about this, I suspect. But we are coming close to the end of the show right now. I want to ask you, I know that you work in prisons and you do all, you work for educational establishments, but can people get in touch with you if they feel that they need your help? Where would they get in touch with you?
Oh, how lovely. I'd love that. So my organization is called Restorative Engagement Forum, and which is a bit of a mouthful, and I slightly regret calling it that. but actually, if you Google me, Charlotte Calkin, you'll get all the ways of getting in touch with me. And I'd love to hear from people. Doing this work is a complete joy. And one of the reasons it's a joy, I'm doing an online course at the moment, and in the room, we have two Russian lawyers who've escaped from Russia since the war, somebody from a very, very large and important third sector charity supporting climate change, and we have three people who are working in a children's home and we have a sports coach and we have an academic. And how great that we've got this great blend of totally different people from different countries and environments all wanting to learn these skills. It's an absolute privilege to do the work.
Oh, well, it's wonderful to hear you talking about it. I think, Mark, I think you will agree with me that it's been a great show today. It's been fantastic talking about restorative justice with you and also learning the differences between that and reconciliation, all those other things that we hear about so much. And also it's been an eye-opener to me to know that it's being taught in some schools. What do you reckon, Mark?
I echo everything you just said. It's been a real pleasure and even more an education. And you have a real gift, Charlotte, for distinctions, for taking something and being extremely precise about it. And it causes me to realize how we can use terms and they can mean different things to different people. And then people jump to the wrong conclusions because they misunderstand them. And you have this gift about drilling down and saying, it's not quite this, it's more like this. And it's just, it's enriched me greatly. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, and me. And so thank you so much for coming onto the show, Charlotte. We've come to the end. And if our listeners are listening in on a podcast, on your favorite podcast platform, and you like what you hear, do share this show. Do share this episode. Give us a like, subscribe. And if you want to review it, do, please. That would be great too. But meanwhile, Mark and I have thoroughly enjoyed our time here today with you, Charlotte. Thank you to everybody for listening. And do join us another time for Hurt Less, Live More with me and Mark Gulston. But until then, goodbye.
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.